This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We are beset by pandemic, unemployment, and social disorder. None of that stops the forces set in motion by our alteration of the land, seas, and atmosphere. The clock of climate change is running, but how fast? Now, from the far reaches of the world, we have evidence that vast ice shelves in Antarctica can retreat 10 times faster than anything we are seeing today. This is credible new science from the Scott Polar Research Institute at Cambridge University. It follows discoveries made from an icebreaker on the far frozen side of Antarctica. There, advanced drones revealed a record of rapid ice retreat, and not that long ago. From Cambridge, our guest is the expedition chief scientist, Professor Julian Dowdswell. Professor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Please tell us about that polar research ship and when this expedition took place.
The research you've described was undertaken on an expedition called the Weddell Sea Expedition 2019. And we went on the South African research icebreaker called Agulhas II into the Weddell Sea. And the aim was to try and reach the area of the Larsen Sea ice shelf, which is on the eastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula. Now, the difficulty with this is that the sea there is covered in most years, for almost the whole year, in floating sea ice, which makes access very difficult. And that's why we had to use an icebreaker like Agulhas II. But we benefited from the fact that a very large iceberg called A68, about 140 kilometres or about 100 miles long, had broken off from the Larsen Sea ice shelf a couple of years ago. And that, to some extent, protected the area that we wanted to access from the worst of the sea ice. So we were actually able, and this is one of the first times in several years that the area has been accessible at all, we were actually able to get the icebreaker in. And then, at certain points, we were able to launch our, as you say, submarine drones or autonomous underwater vehicles with a very high-resolution method of imaging the sea floor. This is a method called multi-beam echo sounding. Now, most people will be familiar with a boat or a ship with a single-beam echo sounder that just measures the water depth immediately beneath the vessel. But a multi-beam echo sounder has about 200 of these beams, which are sent out in a fan shape from the drone just 60 metres above the sea floor, and images, therefore, a whole swathe of the sea floor in very great detail. And because our drones are flying not from the surface 500 metres above the sea floor, but only 60 or 70 metres above the sea floor, that means they get a very high-resolution elevation picture of what the shape of the sea floor is like. And it's this very high-resolution picture that allowed us to image some very delicate sub-meter-scale seafloor ridges, which we think are formed by the upward and downward motion of the point that the ice shelf becomes detached from the seafloor. So if we think of the Antarctic ice sheet, the bulk of the edge of Antarctica, there is a floating ice shelf that fringes the interior of the ice sheet. Now, the two are dynamically a single entity in the sense that ice from the interior of Antarctica flows into the ice shelf and actually feeds the flow of the ice shelf. But the ice shelf becomes detached when it's fully buoyant. It becomes detached from the sea floor. And it's that point, which we call the grounding line, that moves up and down each time the tide goes in and the tide goes out. And what that does is, as the tide goes out and the grounding line sits down on the seafloor, it pushes up a little ridge. Now, if the ice shelf was advancing, then the ridge would be obliterated within hours to days. But because in this case the ice shelf is retreating at the point that these features were formed, that means that each tide, each 12 or so hours, you get another little ridge formed, and it's not obliterated because the grounding line, that interface where the ice becomes detached from the seafloor, is actually retreating. So we image up to 90 of these, backstepping one behind the other, spaced about 20, 25 metres apart. And if we have the view that each one of those little ridges is formed by a tidal cycle every 12 hours. That gives us a record of 45 days. And because we know the amount of retreat, about 20 to 25 metres each 12 hours, that allows us to work out what the rate of the retreat per day is, about 50 metres per day. And then if we average that up over a year, it allows us to conclude that at this point, during the deglaciation of the Antarctic ice shelf about 11, 12,000 years ago, the retreat was actually up to about 10 kilometres or so per year. Now, that's a very interesting number, because if we switch to the modern environment of Antarctica and we look at satellite imagery, which can measure the modern retreat of the grounding line of, for example, the very sensitive Thwaites Pine Island part of the West Antarctic Ocean, which is known to be thinning and retreating quite fast in modern terms, the rate of retreat there is a maximum of about 1.6 kilometres per year, and that is thought to be very fast. But what our results therefore show is that the retreat can, and has been in the fairly recent past, almost 10 times this, 10 kilometres per year, rather than just 1.6. And the reason this is important is because, of course, we've had satellite imagery of the fringes of Antarctica for about 40 or 50 years, and we've been able to use complex radar systems from satellites over the past 15 years or so to work out the details of changing velocities and advance retreat rates. So 15 years is a very short window over which to assess the variability and retreat rates of a whole continent worth of ice. And remember, the Antarctic is bigger than the whole size of Europe, about the same size as North America. So the geological record of these beautiful, very delicate backstepping landforms allows us then to work out 11 or 12,000 years ago, retreat of the ice shelf grounding line was an order of magnitude or about 10 times greater than it is today.
That's not very long ago. I mean, civilization is thought to have started perhaps 8,000 years ago, 10,000 at the most. So just before we started to form cities and become sort of modern selves, there was a major retreat of the ice sheets around Antarctica. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the last time that ice on the globe was a lot more extensive than it is today was about 20,000 years ago. That's what we call the last glacial maximum. Some people call it the last ice age. And at that time, North America was covered by ice right down to the Great Lakes, and New York was covered by ice and so on and so on. And Europe, the ice covered much of Britain, the whole of Scandinavia, parts of Western Russia as well. And so there was a huge amount more ice 20,000 years ago than there is today. And in fact, one of the outcomes of that was that 20,000 years ago, global sea level was 125 metres or somewhat over 300 feet lower than it is today, because the water that built those ice sheets was actually abstracted out of the global ocean. And so both from the geological evidence of past ice sheets 20,000 years ago and from the records of sea level change, we can show that there was more ice on land and therefore less water in the global ocean at 20,000 years ago. But after 20,000, between about 15 and 12,000 years ago, let's say, the climate of the world warmed quite appreciably, and we came out of that ice age or full glacial conditions. And what we're seeing on the Antarctic continental shelf in 500 metres of water today is that at 11,000 or so years ago, the ice front, the grounding line, actually retreated through that point at a rate of about 10 metres per year.
And just, I know there's going to be some confusion with my listeners between sea ice loss, as we see quite a bit in the Arctic, and ice sheet retreat. Can you tell us the difference and why it matters so much?
Yeah, this is a really good question, and it's a fundamental question. So it's really important to distinguish between sea ice on the one hand and glaciers and ice sheets on the other. Now, sea ice is simply the frozen surface of the sea. Sea ice is usually only a few metres in thickness, but it covers vast areas of the Arctic and the Antarctic, particularly during winter. So sea ice, for example, in Antarctica would vary between about 18 million square kilometres of cover in the winter to just 2 or 3 million in the summer. And the same is true in the Arctic. So sea ice is simply the frozen sea surface. It's not as salty as the sea from which it freezes, because part of the salts are actually rejected at the point of freezing of the sea ice. So sea ice is simply frozen seawater. It's really thin, but covers huge areas. Glaciers and ice sheets, on the other hand, are very thick. Glaciers are often a few hundred metres, so let's say about 800,000 feet thick. And ice sheets, the thickest ice sheet in the world is the East Antarctic Ice Sheet, and that is up to, the Antarctic Ice Sheet is up to 5 kilometres or about 3 miles in thickness. But those glaciers and ice sheets are formed in a completely different way from sea ice. They are formed from the precipitation of snow. They're formed from snowfall, and that snow falls on the ground or falls on the ice sheet, and it doesn't all melt during the summer. More falls the next winter, not all of it melts in the summer. More falls again the winter after that, and it builds up and up and up and thickens. And as it thickens, the weight of the overlying snow also densifies the snow beneath it, and it turns into glacier ice. Glacier ice is simply snow from which all the little pathways through which air might go are closed off. So the density of snow is about 400 kilograms per cubic meter, and the density of ice is about 900 kilograms per cubic meter. So it's about double the density of snow. So ice is simply densified snow from which all the little air pathways have been removed. And so glaciers and ice sheets are formed by the precipitation and build-up of snow on land, whereas sea ice is simply the frozen sea surface. And you're right, they do react in different ways to climate change.
So if we were to experience such a rapid retreat in Antarctica, how much new water would that add to the world's oceans, and would that change current sea level projections published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Yeah, I think the important thing to remember here is the features that we show on the Antarctic seafloor are actually demonstrating retreat over a fairly limited period. And we don't expect retreat on the order of 10 kilometres per year to continue over decades, and certainly not over centuries. So it is a relatively short-term phenomenon that probably would act over a year to a few years. And that, indeed, if it happened to a big ice shelf system in Antarctica, would put a little spike into the sea level rise curve. But it certainly does not mean to say that the whole Antarctic ice sheet is going to disappear in a number of centuries. It's not. The Antarctic ice sheet is going to be here in thousands or even tens of thousands of years. It's likely.
But obviously one expedition cannot get a record for all of Antarctica. How do you know your results are not local, perhaps limited to that part of the polar coast?
Really good question. And we have been able, using these autonomous vehicles or drones, to get the most comprehensive coverage over actually an area of about 9 kilometres, several square miles, looking at these features over a relatively large area. We think that a number of reports of these backstepping ridges, which only contain single tracks and are actually at lower resolution, are almost certainly the same features that we report. And those have been observed in several areas of the Antarctic. But because the equipment that the previous workers had was more limited, it's only when we actually get to see a significant area of that with significant lateral continuity that we can say with a high level of certainty that these are actually related to retreat of the grounding line. So I think these features have been observed before, but they haven't been recognized in full for what they are because of the lack of resolution in the systems that acquired the data.
Professor Dodswell, do we know what set off that retreat?
In general, the retreat of the Antarctic ice sheet and the North American ice sheet too, from cold, full glacial conditions 20,000 years ago to the interglacial conditions that we live in today, which are a number of degrees warmer, of course, than that 20,000 years ago. That sequence of glacial, interglacial cycles, warmer and cooler periods in Earth history, has been repeated over the last 2.5 million years or so with a series of cold and a series of warm periods. Now, these are much longer timescales than something generational, decadal, or century scale. These are related to changes that take place over thousands to tens of thousands of years. Each of these cycles is thought to be about 100,000 years long. And the driver or the pacemaker of those glacial interglacial cycles, of which there have been 20-something over the last 2.5 million years, is understood to be changes in the radiation input to the Earth from the Sun. The Earth orbits around the Sun, but its orbit is not completely consistent. It wobbles and it tilts. And there's a periodicity to each of those behaviors. And the strongest period of radiation change is actually a cycle of 100,000 years. And it's thought that those radiation changes relating to the slight changes in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun are actually the drivers of those glacial interglacial cycles. Now, the amount of radiation change is nothing like enough to give us the amount of temperature change that we see on Earth between glacials and interglacials. And it is thought then that internal functioning of the atmosphere, ocean, ice system actually enhance or damp down those initial changes in the amount of solar radiation received in the atmosphere. So it's the periodicity of these astronomical variations, if you like, that is the ultimate driver, but it's internal behaviours of the atmosphere, ocean, ice system that amplify those to get the magnitude of glacial to interglacial change that we actually see.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Is your research able to tell us or to tell governments when this rapid ice meltback could begin?
No, sadly not. It's really difficult to do that. Because the linked atmosphere ocean ice system is so complex, I'm not a numerical modeler, but numerical modelers are trying to deal with this complexity to make predictions, firstly, about what's happening today, to actually make predictions about what's happened in the recent past so that they can test their models, and then to take their models forward to show how things might change, if you like, over the coming century. It's difficult to do this. One of the reasons that I think our recent paper on these delicate seafloor features is quite important is that it actually shows that the retreat of an ice sheet can be a lot faster than we previously thought. And that means that if numerical model predictions predict greater rates of retreat than one might have observed in the satellite record of the last 15 or 20 years, then we would now regard those retreat rates as much more plausible than we would have done in the absence of any modern evidence to show that ice sheets could actually retreat at that rate.
I'm finding science not related to the pandemic is thinning down. The Scott Polar Research Institute says it is closed during the disease. Cambridge, I believe, has announced no on-site classes but all online courses for next fall. Do you think the pandemic and possibly the economy crashing could slow down critical climate science?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, we've been able to, since the lockdown in the UK, we've been able to get everybody working reasonably satisfactorily from home. And so actually a lot of the science that we're doing and a lot of the modelling and a lot of the satellite-based work that we're doing is proceeding at the moment. But clearly, if measures such as distancing and the lack of being able to fly and so on continue for example, next year, this will start to hit the field-based components of our research because we clearly can't go into the field in either the Antarctic or the Arctic right now. So I think that there could be a slowdown in the fieldwork element of this. But I very much hope that a lot of the satellite work can and is continuing. And if I could just comment on Cambridge and teaching, because, of course, I and others in the Scott Polar Research Institute deliver undergraduate lectures as well. The intention is that unless things improve significantly, we will deliver our set-piece lectures, if you will, to 100 or so people remotely. But the hope, and it is that at the moment, is that a lot of the small group teaching in groups of 1, 2, or 3, which is a tradition in Cambridge, it is hoped that that could continue. And it remains to be seen with how the epidemic develops. as to whether we would be able to do that. So the hope is that the small group teaching may be able to be delivered in person, but the large group lectures, it appears unlikely that that will be so.
As soon as I saw your new science, and that sort of emphasized other science I've seen, that things can move faster than we previously imagined, I thought, do we really have the luxury to postpone the climate convention, the COP25, for at least a year, or should we try and hold that online as well?
It's actually quite hard to hold some of these things online. I mean, one of the two very big international conferences for the geosciences are the annual American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco each December, and the European Geosciences Union meeting, which is usually held in Vienna in May. Now, the Vienna meeting was held remotely, and it was really difficult to actually have the same level of interaction, even with what are, in part at least, rather set-piece 15-minute science talks with images and so on and so on. We had 200 people on various platforms trying to interact together, and it wasn't very easy. And when the nature of a meeting is both political as it is scientific, the actual face-to-face discussions and the small breakout groups and so on, I think, are particularly important in trying to get things done. So I can see that it would be quite tricky to actually have that take place remotely.
And we're running out of time here, but I would like to hear just a little bit about the search for the ship Endurance, and keep in mind that perhaps the younger generation have not heard of Sir Ernest Shackleton.
Sure. The other part of our Weddell Sea 2019 expedition, after we completed the site, was to use the autonomous vehicles to try and photograph an image at very high resolution, the wreck of Sir Ernest Shackleton's ship, Endurance. Now, what was Shackleton doing in Antarctica? He was one of the early explorers of Antarctica, together with people such as Captain Scott and the Norwegian Roald Amundsen. Amundsen, of course, was the first person to get to the South Pole, followed by Scott. So after Amundsen and Scott had reached the South Pole just over 100 years ago, in 1911 and 1912, Shackleton, one of the other big polar explorers at the time, thought, what is the great challenge still to be done? And he said, what it is a transantarctic expedition to go from one side of Antarctica to another. And remember that very few people had actually been in Antarctica up till this time. It was very much at the forefront of exploration. Antarctic exploration just over 100 years ago was very much like we perceive people going to the moon. It was very new. It was the headline stuff. And Shackleton said, right, the South Pole's been reached. Now I will undertake a transantarctic expedition, starting on one side of Antarctica and going to the other side via the South Pole. However, on the way down to start the expedition, his ship was trapped in the sea ice, the frozen sea surface, and drifted for 10 months. And the ship was eventually so badly damaged that it sank, crushed by the sea ice, sank through the sea ice to the seafloor. And Shackleton and his 27 men escaped in three open boats, first part of the journey, and then after that, six of them went on an 800-mile open boat journey through very dangerous seas of the Southern Ocean to get rescue, to come back and pick up the rest of the people. So this is one of the epic small boat journeys and rescues ever undertaken. So that's the background to the story. The ship was sunk in an area of the Weddell Sea which is almost always ice-covered the whole time. So we managed to get the icebreaker into that area, and how did we know where it was? Well, Shackleton and Frank Worsley, who was one of his... Worsley was the captain of the Endurance, and Shackleton was actually the leader of the expedition. So Worsley, using sextant and theodolite, measured quite accurately the position at which the Endurance sank. That position has been known for 100 years. The records are held in the Scott Polar Research Institute and in New Zealand. And we know, therefore, pretty much where the ship sank. The Agulhas II, an icebreaker, was able to get there, although only for 36 hours in very tricky ice conditions. They were able to launch one of the autonomous vehicles, and that vehicle did a series of traverses around the last known position of the wreck. But when it was about halfway through its mission, it disappeared from it stopped sending information back to the parent ship. It just sent a little bleep back to the parent ship every so often, and it just disappeared. So we still don't know whether the little drone actually imaged the Endurance or not, because unless the drone comes back, it collects so much data in the form of these images that you can't downlink them through the eye, through the water. They have to actually be recovered when the vehicle is recovered. So the vehicle was lost, and we still don't know whether it actually took images of the ship or not. But it seemed to be one of the great wrecks of the world that has yet to be imaged, and that's because it's in such a difficult location concerning sea ice. And it's particularly famous because of Shackleton's epic survival against the odds after the ship was sunk and he was left in the middle of Antarctica with just three open boats.
But Antarctica has kept this secret in mystery again.
That's right.
Do you have more work planned?
We have work going on in the Institute in Greenland, in Antarctica, and in Svalbard. And we shall hope to continue doing that field work as soon as the pandemic or the aftermath of it allows. And in the meantime, we shall continue doing satellite analysis of the behavior of the modern grounding lines and the modern floating ice shelves of Antarctica, which indeed several people in the Institute are working on today.
We have been speaking with Professor Julian Dowdeswell, director of the Scott Polar Research Institute. He is lead author of the paper, Delicate Seafloor Landforms Reveal Past Antarctic Grounding Line Retreat of Kilometers Per Year, and it was published in the journal Science on May 29th. Julian Dowdeswell, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.